There are several benefits from if you can develop this exercise. One is, especially stepping down, and if you like, is that when you notice maybe a very strong emotion, just remember, is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neutral? Remember, it's based upon a feeling tone. So it can deflate many times. You know, when it comes to emotions, they're very empowered, they're very energetic, they're very volatile. But if you were just to remember to ask yourself, is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neutral? Deflated. Not only that, but it points out something very fundamental to these emotions. I mean, like I mentioned, we usually have so much self-investment in these emotions. You know? But if you can be aware of the basis, that's whether it's the fundamental tone of that feeling, fundamental tone of that emotion. If you look at that, that's much more real. Yeah. For example, if you had something like anger, I mean, you can go in your head and say, well, I have a right to be angry. You know, I've got to get even. I've got to be angry. You know? But how do you feel? Huh? How does anger feel? Pleasant? Well, what are you doing? Why are you indulging in it? That's more real, I would say, than, oh, but I've got to. I've got to be angry. That person made me angry. You know? Yeah, that's just what yourself is saying, but how do you feel? Ugh, you're poisoning yourself. Go back to your body. You feel sick, physically sick. Huh? Right? So, well, you can see that. Why indulge in it? Why do it? For all the reasons in the world, but how do you feel? It doesn't feel good. That's more real than all your rationalizations in the world. Huh? But of course, you know, we have all these investments and we have all this. Sometimes we're just taken over by these habit tendencies. And we don't have any tools to deal with them. But if we lay the foundation, a skillful foundation, and you remember to come back to your breath and breathe deeply, you know, don't get lost in that particular emotion or reaction. Yeah, not very skillful to get lost in it. You know, or we can look at the feeling tones about it. How do you feel? What does it do to you? And especially if you understand the principle of the Buddhist teachings, it's a path of practice to put an end to suffering. Well, I know some people like to suffer, okay. It's an old habit of ours. But you look down at the feeling tone level, and when there's like intuition tells you, this is not healthy, this is not good, this isn't worth following that stuff. On the other side, if you were noticing the nature of feeling tone, pleasant feeling tone, anybody? What does it do to your body? What does it do to your mind? Wow, yeah, you're addicted. You just discovered the pleasure principle. And maybe there might be a few people, maybe if you notice unpleasant feeling tone, anybody? It's a nice sunny day. What does that do to your body? What does it do to your mind? You notice,
contracts.
With pain, with unpleasant feeling tone, contracts. Does it feel good?
No. Yeah.
Yes.
That's why it's unpleasant.
Yeah. There's a kind of a feedback loop there, you see? It's unpleasant, then you contract more, and the contraction is unpleasant, so you contract more, and before you know it, you're in misery. But if you recognize then what pleasant feeling tone can do, now what gives rise to pleasant feeling tone? And what causes unpleasant feeling tone? Sunshine, pleasant feeling tone. Of course, it's a bit short-lived here in Victoria, but don't get carried away with it. We're just lucky today. But we use this as an investigation of this feeling tone, which is a fundamental experience of all sentient beings, as I said. When you can recognize the kind of fundamental principles of it, you can begin to understand what is the basis of pleasant feeling tone. What is the basis of unpleasant feeling tone? And when you understand it, you can gain some control over it. I mean, not ultimate control, because, you know, ultimately things are mostly out of our control. But when you understand the basics of it, what are the conditions that one can cultivate to increase pleasant feeling tone? And what are the conditions that build up to cause us unpleasant feeling tone? Understanding the very fundamental nature, the principles of these fundamental experiences. I mean, the emotions, they get more complicated, you know, very, very complicated. But these fundamental experiences, we all have feeling tone, you know. We have different, and then from there we have different emotional reactions to them. And it gets more and more complicated, but we all have pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. You know this even with your pets, huh? Mm-hmm. What'll make your pet purr, huh? Your cat purr, huh? Food. Simple things. Food, water, comfort, warmth, you know. Well, we're like that too, huh? But a little more complicated. Okay, yeah.
I had an experience. This was an unpleasant feeling tone. And it was yesterday and the day before. And a house across the street from me was being demolished, right? I've never witnessed anything like that before, right? This big machine crunched it down on the top of the house. And about half a day later, or a better part of the day, the house was gone. They hauled it away. And I was feeling really angry. I think, gee, they weren't very environmentally aware. You know, they could have recycled that washer and dryer or some of the wood in that house or the bricks. And I was feeling that was an unpleasant feeling tone. So how should I change that?
Well, what was the primary cause of that unpleasant feeling tone?
I was angry because of... Because of how unenvironmentally aware the people who were demolishing the house were doing, yeah. Or recycling the bricks or the timber or the wood or whatever.
And what can you do about it? Besides get angry?
Write a letter to the...
After the fact. Yeah.
I mean, that was an unpleasant feeling.
Yeah. But I mean, but you see there's a cause and effect process there, right? Yeah. You know, the unpleasant feeling tone didn't just float in from outer space. There was conditions, causes and conditions for it. Now, when you can investigate that, okay, now what can I do here? Can I do anything? Or just get angry and make myself sick? What can you do about it, practically? You know, so, I mean, you know, if you're clear about what the processes are, then you have the possibility to intervene somehow. The possibility. Maybe we don't. Maybe we just don't. But then at least you know. Okay, you know, is it worth just getting angry and frustrated and maybe screaming at your husband later or something? You know, I mean, you know, we have to. These things are loaded, volatile energies, and if we follow this cause and effect process, you may notice how we end up dumping it on somebody or downloading it somewhere else. And, well, is that really, you know, and your husband's saying, what are you angry about? The house across the street. That's not our house, you know. But when you can investigate that, you're aware of anger or unpleasant feeling tone, but what's the causes, and can we do something about it? Sometimes we can't, and we have to say, well, okay, you know, that's the way things are sometimes, but is it worth me getting upset about it? You know, adding more negative energy to the universe, is that really helpful? And you can go over there and kind of send your negative energy to this machine. And maybe it breaks the engine or something, but I don't know. But, we're getting a little bit hypothetical here. but at least you know, you can take responsibility for your particular mood now because you've seen the cause and effect processes. And sometimes there is a possibility to do something. Sometimes, I mean, you're living in this complex society interwoven with many different factors. The owner of the house wanted it knocked down. It's their house, their property. You know, it's not your business, not your money. It's, wait a minute, you know. Okay, I have my, you know, my limited perspective on it, but the bigger picture is it's their responsibility. It's their money. It's their business, really, you know. So, I mean, you know, but at least by knowing that process, you have the possibility maybe to make some changes. Yeah. Sometimes not. Then we're responsible for our own inner world then. And you can recognize it. You know, it's not just you, see. It's not just me doing that. There's a whole series of different factors, and you know, I've let myself be vulnerable to this noise or something, and you know, that you have to be able to know how to look after yourself and your mood, and yeah. Big task. That's why I go live in a cave. Just a few mosquitoes. I have to.
So live.
Yeah. Well, then you also sometimes you have to learn about the situation. So I know the nature of snakes. So I know what their habits are, what their limitations are, and I know about the mosquitoes, and I learn about them. So. You know, if you have to live with mosquitoes, and maybe I can get dengue fever or malaria. Well, I sleep in a mosquito net. And the snakes, I know they come there sometimes, in the rainy season mostly. So I know what to watch out for. You know, the one that comes there is a Malaysian pit viper. So I know that if you just go walk carefully around it, it won't bother you. But if you step on it, it'll bite you. They don't want to bite humans because they aren't very edible. They aren't very tasty, I think. They're too big to digest. So, but if you bother it, if you step on it with unmindfulness, then it's your fault. So you learn also understanding can, you know, you can understanding the nature. Could you really have gone to your neighbor and asked them to recycle the stuff? You know, or is it just, you know, good ideas but impractical? Revenge might be sweet for the other guy too, and his family and his relatives, and you know, sweet on you. So it's, you know, it's a short sentence, it's a short story, but look at the longer story, you know, the longer long-term perspective, you see. Oh, turn off the television. What will be.
It is so interesting, the watching and the watching of the unpleasant, looking at it, mm-hmm. Then almost like the energy rush that then keeps it going, and the TV goes back on, or the
Are you a masochist? Yeah. I mean, there is also in unpleasant feeling tone or in pain, you know, there is another factor to it, is that it does, people do feel energized sometimes. Like some people get a real energy high out of anger. You know, they don't really feel alive, and you know, so there's another aspect to it too. But you know, that energy is not very skillful, not very wholesome, and you better watch out. When you turn the energy on, where's it going to go? You know, is it can be channeled into a a beneficial or skillful way, or is it going to come back to you again? So, I mean, there is this, I don't know if you say this phenomena maybe of, sometimes they talk about the spiritual anger. I mean, it's a different kind. You know, I mean, we look at reality with a certain limited range of variables, you see. And then, like some spiritual teachers, they can maybe express something like anger. Like there was one teacher in Thailand I know, I won't repeat his name, might get sued. But he was known to be sort of a very, I wouldn't say angry person, but he was very, how would you put it? He was very sure of himself. Or he's very, very emphatic in his expression of his moods. And they seem to come across as anger sometimes, especially if you heard second, third-hand stories. It sounded like it. But he came to Ajahn Chah's cremation ceremony, because he was a very important senior monk. And I thought I was going to stay and listen to him talk, because I thought, oh, this is going to be really an interesting one, you know. And he kind of repeated similar things about being critical of the lazy monks and the undisciplined monks and all this. But I was listening from here, and it was where it came from was really a compassionate place. You know, there's another monk, he also gave a talk just before him, and he started kind of ranting and raving about the lazy monks and the undisciplined monks. And the more I listened, I got more and more angry with him. Oh, he was saying the same thing, but where it came from was a very different place. And when this teacher spoke, you know, he said the same thing basically, ranting and raving again about the lack of discipline and the decline of the Sangha. But when I heard it from here, wow, he's really, really peaceful. He's really speaking from compassion, you know. But the other one wasn't speaking from compassion. He was speaking from anger. And the more I listened to it, the more angry I got, because he's triggering that off in me. But the other teacher, no anger at all. It was actually, I was about ready to cry. not quite. but I was expecting him to be, you know, to again hear this ranting. Verbally he did, but emotionally he didn't. Wow, this is quite coming from a totally different place. Yep.
So in the lay world, of hearing something comes from a place that isn't compassion.
Yep.
It is more likely to trigger that.
Yep. Yep.
Even if you're looking to sit there with your heart open.
Whoa, be careful. I mean, when we are exposing ourselves to outside influences, I think you need to be quite vigilant about keeping your heart open or closing it. because it is affecting you, and then you are being motivated, you are being influenced to react or act in another way. And is that way skillful for you or anybody else? You know, you're being triggered off. You're just like a robot being acted upon. And you say, wait a minute, hold it. This isn't very skillful. And you know, there's some of the news. Sometimes I listen to the news, and sometimes I recognize, turn it off is better. You know, it's not doing me any good. I'm not in the right place, not right space to use this skillfully. Better not allow that to happen. So, and you can say, well, I'm just sitting with like an ostrich with my head in the sand, but at least I'm not killing anybody, you know, or creating any more negative energies in the world, you know. So I think that's the kind of a basis first. And then can you really work with that and transform it into something positive? You know, otherwise, you know, you're responsible for more negativity in the world, and that's a heavy responsibility, you know.
Yeah. When I'm hearing that as well, is that it's like the bricks not being recycled.
Yep.
When I'm listening to that news, I have any control.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Doing anything.
Yeah, right. You can't even vote. Can you?
Exactly.
Yeah. Maybe you can throw a brick across into your television set. I forgot that, right? When you're sitting there watching your breath,
yeah.
These
some of the unpleasant, was it pleasant or unpleasant?
Are arising.
For me, it's some things which I believe are from traumatic incidents in my past, mm-hmm. probably stored in my amygdala,
mm-hmm.
according to the brain guys.
So you want a brain surgery, or?
If it would work.
Yeah, no.
I'm just wondering how to deal with that. You're saying
investigation,
but to investigate.
Well, I mean, investigation, I presume that this investigation is a contemplative investigation. So it's coming from a place of calm.
No,
yeah.
These are invasive memories.
Yeah. I mean, it's more beneficial to be able to have a refuge or resource. A peaceful and ideally pleasant feeling tone resource, you know. When you have pleasant feeling tone, you relaxed. It creates a whole different way of relating to these things. Yeah. So it's important to keep that as a kind of a foundation for your practice, you know. But I mean, one danger in spiritual practice is that some people, they create that peaceful resource and they just stay there. They hibernate there. They get lost there. They indulge in it. And then they aren't using that to cultivate spiritual practice, to cultivate wisdom then. See? But the Buddha, if I understand the Buddha's teachings, he encouraged this development of calm and a safe refuge as a point of reference. And then from there, you know, kind of, okay, check out what else is going on, you know. And then if it gets overwhelming, gets too empowered, the negative, you can go back to your resource again. So important to cultivate that resource, that you have a refuge to go back to whenever you need to. Okay? To strengthen you, to give you a different point of reference, to give you some stability. You know? And then, but don't just stay there. I mean, okay, sometimes it's helpful to take a little holiday, spiritual holiday, and tranquility and peaceful experiences sometimes. Yeah? It gives you a bit of confidence. You know, there's other factors that come into it, tranquility and confidence and ability to be flexible and relaxed. And then when you have that skillful attitude, then you're able to deal with difficulties much easier, much more skillfully. So you have to know yourself. I mean, basically, you know, I mentioned these two kinds of meditation, calm and insight. You know, the calm meditation provides that stability in a simple way. You know, there's other factors involved too, but we have to know how much is calm enough to be able to handle what we open up to. And if what we open up to is too difficult, too hot to handle, too volatile, you know, or we just can't relate to it in a skillful way, just back to your refuge again. So you have to know what's calm enough. And each situation might be different. Some of the memories might be not too difficult or volatile, so you can access them fairly easily. Others might be very difficult and stay in the refuge longer to provide a much more stable foundation. And then remember to access them, because the only way to really resolve them is to be able to see through them. So what is their cause? What's the cause and the effect? Processes brought it into being, have created it. What's the root of it? Once we see that, then it's finished forever. But just hiding from it is not going to resolve it forever, ultimately. Though step by step.
Ajahn, just further to that, when you say what is the root of it, in that example, why is the memory arising? Is that what you're saying? what is the root of why the event even happened?
Well, it's more not even the why, it's the how. The how of the process. The why is just, you know, it could be this and it could be that, but how? What's the mechanism there? What's the, you know, what's the self-investment? You know, what's the interpretation I've made of this that it becomes so distorted and so painful? And, you know, the mechanisms, the fundamental mechanisms that are going on kind of without my control, without my approval of it, you know? A lot of that stuff just goes on automatically because, you know, it's beyond the self, beyond our self-control. And so we're just stimulated by it or just pushed around by it. And, you know, then it gets sort of formed into a certain way of a self, way of relating and attitudes and way of responding automatically. Yeah. So what is this process? What is this mechanism anyway? And when you can see through it, you know, now you can say you've made it conscious. What was before unconscious, you made conscious. So now it's, oh, I see this stuff now. And sometimes it'll just dissolve because you don't keep holding that process in place. You don't keep affirming it or approving of it or following into it, you know. So it begins to kind of fall apart if you don't keep empowering it. You know, just like I mentioned about, say, something simple like anger. If you can try and analyze it and figure out and undergo anger management training and all the rest of it, you know, it should probably be expensive. But you can also just look at how you feel. How does anger make you feel? And, if you really can see that, most people will just say, stop, drop it. It doesn't matter why you're angry, but how do you feel? Oh, I don't like it. And at a primal level, we are feeling beings. You know, the rationality came after, and a lot of it is stupid rationality. Based upon false perceptions and wrong understanding and lack of wisdom. So simple. Just dump it. Drop it. I don't the feeling isn't good. But and we have to live with feeling all the time, see. We don't have to live with rationality, that's all extra stuff. But we have to live with feeling. We are fundamentally feeling beings, you see. So that's primal. That's primal stuff. Why you feel that way isn't so important, but I do, and ouch, it hurts. It's not nice.
I'm always curious about decision making. I understand decisions that are made from reasoning, right? Like, you've said such and such a time, I need to be at the airport at such and such a time, and so on. But there are decisions that you make from that place of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
But that might be overlaid, right?
With yep, definitely, yeah, yeah.
Other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How do you wade through that, right? I mean, one of them I think about is proactive decision-making, like you see a situation's unfolding and maybe you need to step away from a job, maybe you need to, you know, take some action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's never clear, right?
Yep. Many of these things are, you know, there's a, what do you say, it's a mixture of many different aspects of our being.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but I mean, if we look at it, kind of what is fundamental, what is kind of, what are the primary elements to concern ourselves with? I can make sometimes a logical decision, but I feel bad about it. So is that worth it? I got to live with my feelings, even though, oh, it's very rational and, you know, and I can, you know, make more money and blah, 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 and I hate it, you know, the feeling level. And you're going to make yourself sick. And maybe in a few years you get ill from it, you know. And even though it was a logical and a reasonable thing to do at the time, yeah, but fundamentally, doesn't the feeling, you aren't happy with it. You haven't got a pleasant feeling out of it. So that's more fundamental, I would say. And maybe you have to, you know, have to then compromise some of these rationalities, this rationality about it, in order to be more attuned with what the feeling, the pleasant feeling tone is about it. So, like I say, the many different aspects. You know, like I say, we have body, we have sensations, we have feeling tones, we have states of mind, are all going on at the same time. Yeah. Then if you're able to listen to them, you can maybe sort them out, what is primary. And yeah, like sometimes if we're sitting here and the pain comes up, it distracts our mind. But sometimes if you can sit with the feeling, with a painful feeling, your mind can settle down. Different relationship to it. But you have to be also sensitive to, you know, how much can your body tolerate. But sometimes it'll distract your mind, sometimes it'll help your mind be more peaceful. So many different factors to juggle, sort of, you know.
And it's just this, roaring fire now, and it happened in such a small amount of time. And what I found is when I have unpleasant feelings towards other people, it's easier for me to conceptualize and work through, because I find I'm pretty good at looking at both sides, and I can move through that easier. But when it's unpleasant towards myself, it's
Was there a question there?
I guess just, how can you, do you have any suggestions of how you can work through that? Would that also then be the process, finding the process, how to
work with it, I guess? Well, it's helpful to be able to have this reference, a safe refuge. So, when that starts, that kind of reactive syndrome starts up, take a breath. Remember your breath. And sometimes just even doing something like that helps to break the kind of feedback loop, you see. You get angry, and then you get angry at yourself, and you get angry at yourself about being angry about yourself, and it's like this, you get caught in a spiral now. So just take a deep breath, and maybe you can interrupt that feedback loop now. And just stay with that. Calm is skillful. There's a few little techniques like this. But if you develop a reasonably good relationship with the breathing, just as a formal exercise, then it's right there. But many people, of course, the breathing is an extra thing they do, but their emotional reactive syndrome is kind of very automatic pilot. So it's important to be able to remember, right, breathing, right, as a point of reference and a refuge. And maybe sometime it just, at the very least, interrupts that cycle and gives you a little bit of perspective on it. And the more you can have that space, I find that the developing the calm meditation provides a certain space between me and the reaction to me and my stuff, you see. So there's a possibility to make some change there. And there's more space to be a little bit more observant of what the whole process is. Yeah. Is it really anger at yourself, or is it, you have a certain ideal. I've got to do this, or I should be able to do this, and I can't, and so I'm failing. But, you've had an unrealistic expectation about yourself. So, of course, you can always fail. Expectation means you know, failure. Expectation means disappointment. So no expectation, you know. I mean, you need a certain amount if you're going out to climb a rock or something, I mean, you need something. You need, oh well, I'll get to the top. You know, I need some general. But now let's be realistic about it. Am I just being idealistic or realistic? Yeah, I'll try it. Yeah. I mean, I lived a long time, in 17 years in Switzerland, and most of the time up in the Swiss Alps. And occasionally we had time to go out and do some walking in the mountains there. And you learn quite a few lessons about expectation. And many people, they look on the map and say, oh, I want to go to that mountain. Yeah. And then they go out there, and the weather's changed. You've got to check out the weather, your energy level, the time of day. And maybe it's just not suitable. Yeah. I tell the story about from my room in the monastery. I look out the window, and there's a big rock up there, kind of funny looking rock sticking up. They call it the Spitzenstein. And one day I was looking out at it, and I thought it'd be interesting to be up there and look down here, rather than be down here all the time and look up. So I thought, when I had time to go for a walk, I thought, okay, I'll just make my way up there. And I know that expectation means disappointment. So I learn how to just set off in a general direction and check it out, you know. And the experience really to me is just is going there, not getting there, but going there. So I started up the mountain, and I got up above the tree line. It's just not too far away. I can see it, you know. And my adrenaline's starting to rush, and I'm almost there, you know. I mean, it doesn't really excite me getting there or not. I mean, the getting there is the whole thing for me. But I went up to the scree line, the scree slope. So the path goes zigzag across the scree slope. And I'm being very clever, and I think, why go zigzag when I can just go straight? So I climbed straight up the line here, up the path. There was no path there. I just went straight up. And I got up there, and I'm on the wrong ridge. Unbeknownst to me, the path went zigzag and then crossed over there. So by then it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's not a good idea to be out after dark. It might turn into a pumpkin. So okay, that's it for the day. It was a pleasant experience, so I headed down. Next time I had a chance to go up there, I recognize that one. Don't be too clever. Follow the path. So I got across the other ridge, and the rain clouds came over. Uh-huh. 3 o'clock and rain clouds. No, not a very good idea to be up there. I'm a prime lightning bolt candidate. So finally, the third time wiser, I went up and followed the path, and lo and behold, I was there. And it was nothing special. So what? Another big stone. And I look back at the monastery way down there, and I was just a little window like this big, you know, so I couldn't hardly see it. But especially something like rock climbing, I mean, it's important to be very present. Huh? If you get angry, you might fall. Huh? Beware. Being more mindful and collected is more healthy and safer, and yeah. Just beware the rock or breathing. And then maybe, you know, that if you could emphasize the calm, okay, maybe the anger's still there, but it kind of takes a back seat. And then it's not so overwhelming, and maybe you get some perspective on it and see why. What's the process here? What's behind it all? Why are you beating yourself up? You know? don't be so optimistic. I mean, don't be So you're saying that you do nod off, and then you... Could be, yeah. Well, notice the process of falling asleep. I mean, it is a cause and effect process. You know what happens in this. You can look at this kind of complex of, say, falling asleep. Now, what's the kind of cause and effect processes that involve there? And especially, this is really helpful for beware of feeling tone. What's the feeling tone there before you nod? Pleasant. let's see now. So, are you tired? Yeah. I mean, if you're aware, maybe you have to be aware of the energy level in the body before you sit. You know, is it suitable to sit then? If your body is tired already, then sitting is probably not such a good thing, because you're just going to get more, you're tired, and then you're going to get more sleepy and dull, and your body needs a rest. So maybe you need to be able to change to more active, something more active, rather, or rest even. Or find a posture which is a bit more restful, that's not going to exhaust you further. First of all, when I notice sleepiness, then I ask myself, is it physical or mental? Is there a physical basis to it or a mental one? And the physical one, well, there's a few things you can do. You know, sit more upright, open your eyes. I'll tell you my little secret one. When I'm sitting up here with my hands like this, it's a little bit, if I get sleepy up here, then it's a bit awkward, because I just can't get up and do some exercises and, you know, stand on my head and things. You know. So I massage the fingers. It's a type of reflexology. You heard of that? Yeah, if you massage the fingers, you know, you get the circulation going. Yeah. Not only is it a little bit active, if you like, you know, mindfully massage my fingers, and it's a little bit active, plus it does stimulate the circulation. Yeah, and some of the fingers, they're more painful than others, and and nobody notices, maybe. Anybody notice that? They'll be looking for it now, probably. Look, he's massaging his fingers, he's sleepy. There is a chapter in the book about the hindrances about sleepiness. It's quite a long chapter. Even the suggestions from the Buddha were quite detailed, because it must have been a very common problem. But there were things like, there were exercises the Buddha suggested about pulling your ears and pulling cold water on your face and that, and if you're still tired, you change postures and walk, and if you're really tired, then have lay down and mindfully go to sleep, and intending to wake up in, you know, have a power nap, so you tend to wake up in an hour, half an hour or something, and yeah. Well, not power napping in here. You have to do it kind of a little bit, a little bit quietly. But basically, any particular so-called hindrance one has, the Buddha recommends that we try to investigate it. What's going on here? I say that these hindrances, they are expressions of our ego, of the self, in some form or other. So especially, I mean, there are some of them which relate to just physicality, the body, like the body is physically fatigued. Yeah. But I mean, if it's our identification with the body that compounds that, why if we, oh, I'm tired, and we identify with the body and then get even more tired. And then maybe we fight with that and get even more exhausted. So if we recognize that, then we try to study what's going on here. And you can learn a lot about yourself. Maybe the unpleasant side of yourself, but my sleepy self, my greedy self, my angry self. But that's usually the aspect of ourself we haven't been looking at. So that's why we're blind to it. We don't know about it. Well, basically, sensation is physical and feeling is already a mental.
But it's not necessarily a thought process.
Nope. Yeah, but it is mental, yeah. It's kind of very, very primal mental activity or process, feeling tone. And the physical, I mean, you can say the sensation is an expression of the physical. But of course, you need a mind to be conscious of it. See? But you'll see that it's very physical based. You turn to the body to get a sensation, and then there is a feeling tone associated with it too. Initial way it is, until you learn to read it more carefully. See, at first it's learning the language, like maybe it's like learning a language. Okay, this is a language of feeling tone. It feels like this, and maybe in the beginning we have no frame of reference for it. But if you stay with that as a kind of a theme to investigate, you begin to get a sense for it. Without having to revert to your intellectual, is this pleasant or is it unpleasant? Maybe at first you may have to do that. Is this, or just remember in your mind that is there only three of them: pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. See, and then okay, now go back to the direct experience. Now, is this sensation here, is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Well, when I first look at it, it's sort of a little bit on the side of unpleasant. I'm pressing too hard. But maybe you look at it again and, oh, when you're more conscious of it, it changes to being pleasant. But then you get a certain sense of it. So you're like, you're learning the language of it now. This is sensation here. Yeah. I mean, there because there is the part of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, but then there is the whole wider experience of feeling tone. And maybe it goes, too far into an emotion. Emotion is, there's a pleasant feeling, and then the emotion is, I like it. And then I want it. That's a mental state there. I want it. How can I get it? Oops, okay, if you know a bit about feeling tone, you recognize, oh, the liking part probably is a pleasant feeling tone. So then if I turn my attention to this area of feeling, oh yeah, there it is. I like that. Yeah. That's what it is, pleasant. So you just start to get a little bit of a, direct experience of it. And it's a little bit playing back and forth. If we're very conceptual, well, it's, we got to kind of come back from the conceptual and try and get into the direct experience more, and some people, they're already naturally quite feeling people, but they aren't very conceptual about it. They can't distinguish it. They already, we have these tendencies to pleasant and unpleasant, neutral, but I'm not very conscious of that as a particular experience of independent of the concepts about it or something. And now I'm more conscious of feeling. Oh, so I can look at that part, the feeling part of my experience now. Or I can look at the sensation part of my experience or the mental part of my experience. And sometimes there will be parts of it which will be, you say, very, very activated, you know. And if you look at it, look at the activated part, you just, phew, you could take off into your story about it. Or if you can look at, okay, what's the feeling tone about it? Like I mentioned about the emotions. How does anger feel? Anger, wow, I got a long story there, but how does it feel? Simple, simple story. That one, it doesn't feel nice. So, I mean, you just kind of keep going with it a bit and maybe it becomes a bit clearer. How do you feel right now? Pleasant?
I feel like my question was, I've got a clear idea of it.
Uh-huh. That's not a feeling, that's a thought. How do you feel? Pleasant? Unpleasant? Neutral? Oh, because you're the focus of attention. Okay. I mean, it's very common for people, especially men, to confuse feeling and thoughts about it. You know, I feel like I should be understood. That's not a feeling. That's a thought. That's a thought. It's not a feeling. But gradually, if you just give more attention to that area of our experience, even we haven't got language for it, or the more we can give attention to it, it begins to kind of come into focus. And ideally, yeah. There's a waving hand over here too. You attracted my attention.
Yeah. So just back to what you were explaining, I really like this, by the way. It's a structure I haven't quite heard of, and it's really going to be bring up a new dimension of my practice, so I'm very grateful for it. So I tend to be more with the thoughts, so when you're getting to feeling, I understand like a physical feeling, like when you're touching your hand.
Sensation?
Sensation. But it can also be, you're saying, a feeling of well-being without going to the story. So you can stay, like, kind of rest in a state. When you were saying to this woman back in the back here, get to some refuge so that you can feel some peace and the calm.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't want to get carried away with a story that gives you peace and calm, because that's thought, right? You want to stay more in a general zone of feeling.
Well, the feeling tones are more primal stuff.
Okay.
You know, you can make up all kinds of stories, but you know they're a little bit extra to the primal experience.
But it can be a feeling or like a sensation, which would be actual, like your
physical. Yeah, the sensation
physical.
Is physical based. Yeah. Yep. So once you know you can recognize, say, pleasant feeling tone, then you investigate its characteristics, its parameters, what causes it, what interferes with it, then you can learn to cultivate, you know, the skillful ground. And then there's, the Buddha points out, there's, like what I mentioned, that he mentioned that joy is a factor of awakening. But this is a spiritual joy. It's not a sensual joy. Distinguishing between the sensual realm, sight, you know, beautiful sights or pleasant sights, sound, smells, taste, touch, which are very ephemeral, they aren't very reliable, to a spiritual joy, which is a little bit more firmly based, you can say, in reality. You know, when the Buddha was awakened, He gave the definition of Nibbana, or awakening, as the ultimate well-being, well, it's not quite happiness. It's not like going to a party, Nibbana party, and or like happy hour, you know. It's a different dimension of happiness or well-being. A totally different dimension. It's like complete, you know, I mean, it's even ecstasy is a bit too exciting. Would you believe? That's what they say anyway. I don't know yet, but so this joy or rapture is sort of a different dimension of well-being, but you can get a sort of a taste of it through recognizing pleasant feeling tone, yeah, an unpleasant feeling tone, you see. You can get a little bit of a practical experience of it and what encourages that, what increases that. And then you may notice that, I mean, the attenuation, you know, of the self and all of its problems and stories is much more inclined towards joyfulness and peacefulness and, should I say, ecstasy even? Where when you go into the stories, it's not very pleasant usually. I mean, you can create fantasies, you know, but they're just created, see? So they aren't very well grounded in reality then. They're just made up. So like, you know, something like, oh, thinking positive thoughts can be helpful to a degree. You know, like actually in one of the... I might be giving Brock's theme away, but there's a meditation on metta bhavana, well-being, loving kindness. I mean, want to explain it, but you can bring up those thoughts, you know, and then after a while, maybe it's just a thought first. May I be well, but then if you can tune into it, what is that well-being, as a feeling tone, you know, as a more substantial experience rather than just a good idea. Then you can begin to recognize it and plug into it, and then you can even generate it without having to think about it. You've got right to the source, and you can generate now well-being. And then maybe you can to the point where you can just you can just bliss out. Of course, maybe wrong place, wrong time. But if you know what the characteristics are and what generates it, you know, now you're a bit more in tune with kind of primal experiences of human beings, pleasant, unpleasant. Yeah. And you observe what your particular expressions of it or your particular experiences of it are. You know, maybe some of your stories are very pleasant. You know, maybe some of them not so pleasant. So, well, but sometimes you can't choose, especially in the stories. Huh?
Jim, do you have any guidance on or suggestions on how to build sustained effort at this kind of, you know, paying attention to this process? Day in a householder's life is rather long and full of stimulus. About 7:30 in the morning, it's easy to kind of lose the track.
7:30 in the morning.
So I don't know if this is a sort of a failure of effort or a failure of mindfulness, but do you have guidance on kind of sustaining this?
Well, there's many kind of practical methods. You know, I mean, it's helpful to have maybe a regular practice for following the formal exercises that can give you some momentum and support. And then looking around in your daily life, what's disrupting that now? You know, what's really undermining that particular sense of mindfulness or clarity, whatever, what really disturbs it, you know? And then see if you can limit that, and then what encourages it, what supports it. You know, there are in all these things there are cause and effect processes involved in it. And that's another one of the Buddha's fundamental teachings about the principle of cause and effect. So when you can, first of all, you have to kind of isolate what that is, tranquility or mindfulness, and then, okay, what's supporting it, what's nourishing it, what's causing it to decline or fade away or disrupting it or disturbing it or whatever. So you try to limit the disturbances and increase the support of it, nourishing of it. Yeah. And you look around in your practical, that's where it's helpful to be able to apply this to your practical life situation, because that's where you spend most of your time, you know, at work, say, for example. And the Buddha said right livelihood was one of the factors of the Eightfold Path, right livelihood. Why is that? You know, because many people spend a large percentage of time, a large percentage of their time at their livelihood, and if it's sort of soul-destroying, spiritually quenching, you know, 1 hour on the cushion isn't going to do much for 8 hours of soul-destroying work. So maybe you have to look around and see. I mean, the Buddha mentioned what was wrong livelihood specifically, but, you know, nowadays people have jobs and a wide variety of different activities, and some they aren't really soul-destroying, but, I mean, they do upset you or disturb you or worry you or cause you anxiety, and, you know, is it worth continuing with that? And if you bring that into your life, then maybe, you know, you got to be really quite honest with yourself and what's my priority? You know, being anxious ridden but getting rich, or being poor and peaceful? No, it's maybe, you know, not quite so simple, maybe. And sometimes maybe just slight adjustments. You know, like in Switzerland, a number of our supporters, they got more interested in spiritual practice, and then they just cut down how much work they do. And, you know, if your priority is spending more time in spiritual practice, you know, you've noticed that if you simplify your life, you don't have to slave away 9 to 5, 5 days a week. Yeah, how much is enough to supply your basic necessities for life, but still have some time and energy left over for spiritual nourishment too? Yeah, maybe you have to balance it out. So some people, they've reduced their workload to 70% or 60% or whatever, and they find they simplify their life and much more peaceful. And before, they were working 100% and really stressed out and with it. Yeah. So I don't know if they can do that here or not, but in some countries you can take a reduction in how much time you put in or something. So should we have another walking session while the sun shines?